Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Hey, do you remember that movie, Wet Hot American Summer? I mean, probably not, because it absolutely bombed when it came out, even though it had the craziest cast. Seriously, Google the cast of this movie. But the title of it keeps coming back to me these past few weeks. Because, well, fun fact, did you know that for the past 5 years, New York City's heat and humidity has been so bad it actually now qualifies as a subtropical zone? Amazing! Great job, everyone. Life is awesome when you feel like you're constantly covered in a thin layer of apricot glaze. But this episode, well, this episode is here to make things better, because it will remind you of a whole bunch of things to really love about an American summer. We've got a cross-country road trip in search of hot dogs with the hilarious comedian and writer Jamie Loftus. We've got the how-tos to throwing a delicious, sweaty, all-day, all-night Mexican cookout with steak marinated in beer with Priscilla Lopez. And to start, we've got baker Stacy Mayan Fong, who created 50 pies to celebrate all 50 states. So when Stacy moved to the U.S. after growing up all around Asia, she fell in love with what she thought of as the most American food, pie. And when she decided to make it official and make our country her home, she also decided to really get baking. Her debut cookbook about all the pies she made to honor her new country and the friends that showed her around this great land is called 50 Pies, 50 States, an immigrant's love letter to the United States through pie. Hey, Stacy, thanks for coming by.
Hey, Francis, I'm so happy to be here.
So you grew up in like many different places before settling in America as your home. So why did you choose to commemorate all 50 states?
So I was born in Singapore and I grew up in Hong Kong and Indonesia. And then I came over here for college in Savannah, Georgia, which it's a big move and a really funny move. And I decided to bake the 50 pies because I was in the process of applying for my green card. And I thought it'd be really fun to learn about the country that I've chosen to call home through its food in the most American food I could think of, which is pie.
Why? What is it about the pie that's like screams America to you? As like someone who wasn't like raised here and wasn't raised with pies, like what is it about the pie that said to you, this is like a purely American form?
I feel like there's pie in every single form in this country. Like every single form of celebration, there's always a pie on the table. Mm. And I grew up watching a lot of American movies and listening to a lot of old country music. And it was always like road trips where they like stopped at diners where they would grab a slice of pie. And it just seemed like pie was like synonymous with like either like a homecoming, a celebration, or like a feeling of comfort. Mm-hmm, and those were all things that I was kind of looking for when I started my project and I was applying for my green card. Yeah. And so it was kind of like figuring out what home meant, and pie seemed like the most like tender and homey thing.
That's so interesting. Well, actually, tell me about growing up, because I think like the book is 50 States, 50 Pies, but you actually start the recipes with pies that are not from America. They're kind of, you kind of tell your own story in pies first. There's a Singapore pie and there's a Hong Kong pie. So what does home mean to you? Like having grown up in different countries and different cultures and then, you know, choosing to move to the United States?
So I feel like, you know, when you grow up, you're taught that home is like where your family is. It's a house. It's a physical place.
Sure.
But what I've come to realize is that home really is like a mindset. And then like how you feel with the people that you surround yourself with, like that's kind of what home is to me now. Mm-hmm. And when I started the project, I knew with the cookbook, I needed to like introduce you to myself a little bit. It's like I feel all the pies that came before the 50 are like the first three dates, and then I convince you to like come on this road trip with me. Like you had to get to know me and understand like why I would even want to do this in the first place.
Sure.
And it's like Yeah, like home, I feel like, is a thing that you make for yourself. And all the other moves in my life were dictated by my dad's job and everything. And my move to America was very much my choice. Like, I chose to come here for college. I chose to stay here and build a life here. Mm-hmm. And like, the people that I've met in the 17 years now I've lived in the States, like, they've made this place a home. Like, it's not so much America itself, but it's people, the people.
Sure. And like, you actually do this really lovely thing where you dedicate every pie in the book to a friend or someone you met or someone taught you something about the place they're from, the state they're from, or the state they've spent time in. So we should note that the 50 pies are not like, oh, this is like the official state pie of Indiana or whatever. Like, you have, you know, either traveled there or talked to people or read up and studied, and you've created pies that sort of symbolize your idea of what each state is. Tell us how you went about that.
Yeah, so the pie that I made for each state is, I'm not saying it's like the be-all, end-all for that state. Like, no one is signing any paperwork to declare it. You know, this is like purely like my interpretation based on like state foods or the state fruit or like some sort of regional cuisine. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like me exploring that state for the first time. It's like, you know, when you go to a new country, you like want to try all the dishes that are like that country is famous for. It's like, I wanted to go to West Virginia and like figure out like what makes, what is the most West Virginia thing to the person that I gave the pie to.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the West Virginia pie?
So the West Virginia pie is a pepperoni roll pie. So it's got hot cheese, pepperoni, and marinara in the center. And then it's got a pepperoni stuffed crust, like a la, you know, like a Pizza Hut. And I basically came to that pie because my friend Jeffrey, who the West Virginia pie is dedicated to, he would always talk to me about him growing up in West Virginia and eating pepperoni rolls either like after school or like on the weekends. And I kind of thought about that and made the connection about how in Hong Kong, like after school, like I would stop by a Chinese bakery that would have like a milk bread with a hot dog in it. And it was funny that me and Jeffrey grew up on two sides of the world, but kind of did like a similar thing after school or ate like a similar snack. And I wanted to like interpret that some way to represent how I feel about West Virginia and how Jeffrey feels about West Virginia.
Yeah, I love that. First of all, it, you know, sausage stuffed in bread is just a good idea anywhere in the world, it turns out.
Yep.
What state did you start with?
I did the pies in alphabetical order.
You sat there and was like, okay,
it made the most sense. Yeah, it made the most sense to me, like organizing my thoughts, because 50 pies is a lot of pie. And so it was very overwhelming to think about it. Some people have asked me why I didn't do it in the order that the states entered the union. But I was like, can anybody really off the top, maybe some people could, good for them, name like the states in the order that they entered the union. But also I was like, just organizationally, it never made sense to me.
Well, I mean, there's 13 of them to start.
Yeah.
I guess Delaware is the first state.
Delaware's first. Delaware's okay, number one.
I remember that one. This is like, you know what this sounds like? This sounds like the kind of test that they make you take, like when you're trying to get naturalized and you have to like take a test. And it's like, no native-born American would ever pass that test because it's full of stuff that like...
It's the most random history that like, it's really, really good for like bar trivia.
Yeah.
But for like everyday life, it's like not useless information, but like information that you don't need.
Yes.
So
exactly.
Doing them alphabetically made the most sense to me. And also it made it easier for people to find what their state was if they were looking for it, you know?
Sure. Okay. So what are some of your favorite pies that you've made?
Oh man, that's a tough choice. That's so tough because it's like, you know, picking your favorite child. I feel like West Virginia, we talked about, is one of my faves. Also Minnesota, that's the one that I feel like has been the most, like, people have a lot of opinions about it because it is a corn dog hot dish pie with savory funnel cakes. And that pie was dedicated to my old design director when I worked in fashion. And Rebecca always goes back to the Minnesota State Fair every year. And her two favorite things were funnel cake and corn dog. So I was like, how can I make this into pie form? So I made it a corn dog hot dish pie because everybody loves a corn dog. And then I was like, what if I did funnel cakes for like a little bit of texture on top, so everything's not one note. And I made them savory because savory crispy fried is always good.
That is a truly extra pie. But having gone to the Minnesota State Fair, it is a truly extra event. So it's a corn dog hot dish pie with funnel cake topping. So walk us through what the actual recipe is. How do you incorporate all three of those ideas into one item?
So it's kind of like a cornbread casserole. So it's like cornbread with cut up hot dogs in a casserole inside the pie. And it's got the savory funnel cakes on top. And then, of course, it's served with ketchup or mustard, you know, personal preference. And yeah, it's just like kind of a fun thing that's like pretty structurally integral. So you could slice it and hold it and walk around the state fair.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, let's get to some sweet pies. I want to talk to you about the paella from Massachusetts, because it is possibly the funniest food item I've ever seen. It is a Boston cream pie.
Yes. Which, so true.
for those of us who do not know, who have not been indoctrinated into the school of absurdity, the Boston cream pie is a cake. Boston cream pie is not a pie. Boston cream pie is literally a layer cake. So you have a pie that is the Boston cream pie. You have rectified this complete wrong in the universe.
Pretty much. And I feel like I just thought it would be like the funniest thing to do, to make a thing that's called a pie, like into a pie. It was so strange to me that I was like, when I first heard of Boston cream pie, I was like, oh, it's a pie. And then I was like, no, it's a flavor of a donut. And then I was like, no, it's actually a cake. And so I was like, how can I make this cake into like a very decadent pie? And so it ended up being, it has a chocolate ganache on the bottom, a vanilla custard filling, and then pieces of pound cake on top. Because like, what's better than one dessert is two desserts in one. Yeah. So I kind of like flipped the script on a Boston cream pie.
Oh my God, I love it. So it's like a standard flaky pie crust coated in the ganache, then the custard, and just like chunks of pound cake.
Yes, mountain of pound cake with more ganache on top. So it's a lot of a lot, but I feel like Massachusetts sometimes can be a lot. So,
yeah. Or this country. I mean, that really should be our slogan. It's not from many one. It's a lot of a lot.
It's a lot of a lot,
America,
exactly.
It's a lot of a lot. We'll be back with more with Stacey Mei-Yan Fong, author of 50 Pies, 50 States. And then, what's more American than a hot dog? Well, a road trip fueled by hot dogs. We've got comedian Jamie Loftus, author of Raw Dog. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APN. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're all about classic summer vibes today, with hot dogs and carne asada coming up. But right now, we're getting back to our chat with Stacey Mei-Yan Fong, author of 50 Pies, 50 States. Okay, let's get to some fruit. I love that we've talked about pie now for like 15 minutes or whatever, and we haven't actually got to a single fruit pie, although there are many wonderful fruit pies. Although, to stay with the it's a lot of a lot theme, your Washington pie is... Well, tell us about your Washington pie.
So for Washington, I knew it had to be Rainier cherries because it was a cherry born in Washington. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to add a little apple in there to kind of mellow out how tart a Rainier cherry could be. But something that I love is the combo of like sweet and salty. And another thing that was really fun while I was researching for all the recipes for each state was finding out everybody's like regional like sodas and potato chips that like for some reason they don't cross like a few certain states it stays within. And I guess Washington's is Tim Cascade's potato chips, which I had to order on Amazon, and they were very, very delicious. Even though I will say that Cape Cod is still my favorite potato chip. I knew I wanted, like, shout out to Massachusetts. I wanted, like, you know, like a salty element to the sweet Rainier cherry pie, because anybody can really make a cherry pie. Like, how could I make this cherry pie mine and the one that would be perfectly Washington-esque? And so I did a Rainier cherry and apple filling, and then it's got a savory potato chip crumble on top. So you get a little bit of sweet, a little bit of salty, and a little bit of sour. So everything you really want in a dessert.
That sounds so good. Tell me about the potato chip crumble. How do you make a potato chip crumble?
It's really just a traditional crumble topping, which is like brown sugar, flour, butter. Mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. I crushed up like a bag of potato chips and like added it in. The potato flavor doesn't really come through. It completely gets like kind of covered by everything else, but you get the salty and then the texture.
Mm-hmm. So do you bake the crumble first and then?
Yes. The chips and the crumble get baked together.
Okay. Okay.
Like separately from the rest of the pie. And
right.
They get finished in the oven together because I didn't want the filling to get dried out and then the crumble to get burnt. So it's kind of like it's a little more finicky, but it's very much worth it.
Right on. And I have to say, I was surprised that Delaware got a peach pie.
So Georgia is a peach pie too, but I knew that Delaware had to be a peach pie as well, because Delaware, contrary to popular belief, is actually the first place peaches were planted in the United States. Not only was it the first state to enter the Union, but also the first place to have peaches.
There's so much. Delaware has such a proud history.
Yeah.
So now you've created all these pies for all these different states. Like, do you ever feel like, oh my God, what if I get this wrong? Like, people get very territorial. Like, have you heard people say, like, that is not New Jersey at all?
100%. And I welcome it.
You sound like you welcome it.
I welcome it. I love starting the conversation. And, you know, it's like what we said before. Like, I'm not saying that this is the be all end all. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of like starting the conversation. And it's also like, this is my interpretation of New Jersey. And I'd love to know what other people would have done. Like, you know, for Pennsylvania, some people are like, oh, like that makes sense. But I would have done X, Y, Z. And I'm like, I want to know. Like, I want to know. Maybe I'll make an addendum. Maybe I'll bake more pies, or maybe you could bake a pie and show me like what you would have done for Minnesota instead of double fried food state fair, you know? So it's like, it's kind of fun. About the fun thing about pie is that it's really a blank canvas. Mm. And I grew up in two British colonies where pie was more of a savory thing than it was a sweet thing. And then I moved over here, and like in America, it's like custard pies, fruit pies. And it's like, thinking outside of that 10-inch circle, you know, and like using it to like interpret like how you would see your state or how you would represent your state, what's better than sparking a conversation like that, you know?
Oh, I love that. How'd you get into baking pie?
So I got into baking pie because I was having a rough go at life when I was 25 in New York City, as most people do when they're 25 in New York City. And my best friend Patrick bought me the cookbook for the 4 & 20 Blackbirds Pie Shop. It's a big pie shop here in the city. It's my favorite pie shop. And I ended up Julie and Julia style baking my way through the entire cookbook and realized that I really loved baking pie because, like, the process is a little complicated. It's very finicky. You have to kind of finesse it. But essentially, all the ingredients are really simple. And then at the end of it, you get this like warm slice of goodness that makes all the like strife that you might have suffered before seem a little less complicated. And also, living in the city, everything is very noisy. Mm-hmm. And getting to just like refocus everything, focus on baking your pie at hand, like that's kind of like nice. Like, I feel like people in New York spend their whole time finding quiet moments. And I found like my happiest and most quiet moments while I was baking pie. And then like I got to have, you know, the sharing of it. So then I got to hang out with my friends after because like you can't eat a whole pie. I mean, you can. I'm not going to tell you what to do. You know, live your life. But
it's America. Like,
It's a lot of a lot. Wear your soft clothes and eat a whole pie. Yeah. But like, yeah, like I got into baking pie basically because therapy at the time was a little too expensive. Yeah. And, you know, it really helped me kind of open up like what food meant and what sharing food meant and the process of baking and all of that good stuff. You know, you never know what can happen in the kitchen.
You never know. Well, this has been a blast. Thank you so much for taking us on your therapy journey, Stacey.
Thank you, Francis. This is the best. Truly a dream come true.
Stacey Mei-Yan Fong is the author of 50 Pies, 50 States, an immigrant's love letter to the United States through pie. She left us with her recipe for the great state of Minnesota and the world-famous state fair. Find her corn dog, hot dish, funnel cake pie at splendidtable.org. The comedian Jamie Loftus has, I guarantee you, written the absolute best anti-capitalist critique of the history of hot dogs wrapped up in a travelogue about a cross-country road trip to find the best hot dogs in the nation. Her book Raw Dog is truly the single best entry in that whole entire literary category. And here she is to tell us about it. Hey, Jamie, it's great to see you.
It's great to see you, too. Thanks for having me.
I truly love hot dogs. I thought I loved them more than anyone I know because I was like, well, I have a whole rule about whenever I'm in Chicago, I have to eat one whole hot dog a day. But honestly never occurred to me to drive back and forth the entire country multiple times eating like four hot dogs a day.
Well, if it makes you feel better, I think that that's pretty common. I don't think it's occurred to many people. Maybe because it's a bad idea, you know, just because you can. So is Chicago style your go-to? What's your make? It's a good opening question for meeting anybody, really.
Yeah, is Chicago style your style? Yeah, no, I have a real thing for the Chicago dog. I love the squishy poppy seed bun. I love that weird neon green relish.
I do love the relish.
You know, the seven canonical ingredients or whatever, and like that really good snappy Vienna beef hot dog. I grew up in New Jersey though, so probably like the most natural state of hot dog for me is, well, frankly, either like boiled on the stove from the supermarket.
Yeah.
But I think like our regional style is the Ripper, right? That's the one where like you cook the hot dog by throwing it into the deep fryer until it actually bursts.
Rutz is an all-timer.
No joke. I have been to Rutz Hut. I didn't know it was like such an iconic place. I'm just like, oh, I used to drive there when I was in high school.
Yeah, that's the one. That's truly the one. I feel like I know because I've been to Chicago twice since the book came out, and it's a very curt relationship I have with the Chicago hot dog community at this point. I said some things I can't unsay.
Oh God! Oh God! Wait, was it the ketchup thing? They are weird about ketchup.
My ultimate issue with the Chicago hot dog community, it's not my favorite make, but that's fine. It's more the hostility towards ketchup that does bother me. I feel like it's one thing to not like, I don't know. It's just, I just have a real thing about hating on other people's condiments. Like, where do you get off?
I'm with you. I think the Chicago dog is maybe a perfect food, but I don't understand why people in Chicago look upon people who enjoy ketchup with their hot dogs as subhuman creatures. I don't get that.
But I think ketchup lovers should be a protected class.
So like I said, I have never really considered going on a cross-country road trip to, you know, find what you have described so beautifully as a filling and affordable alternative to health. But why did you?
It was for a lot of reasons. For a long time, I've done a deep dive, really specifically themed podcasts for a couple of years now. And when I started doing those, I made a list of topics of any kind that I would feel comfortable living with for 6 months or more and not get sick of no matter what. And hot dogs were always at the very top of the list. Mm. I love hot dogs. I grew up with hot dogs. They were my favorite food as a kid, which I know is not unusual at all. But then when I realized that this was like a topic I could spend forever with because they're this really strong, potent, specifically American for better and for worse symbol that everyone feels strong about, but like no one can really put their finger on why. And there was nothing written about that. There's been very little outside of And I say this with love because they were very helpful to me. But outside of like rankings of the best hot dogs or like the best hot dogs from region to region, there wasn't really very much written about their history, and there wasn't much written about why they are kind of the cultural American icon that they are. And so I was kind of excited to realize that hadn't happened, because it's a book I wanted to read, and also a book that I thought I could trick people into being interested in reading.
Come for the hot dog road trip, stay for the invention of the steam-powered sausage chopper.
Exactly, exactly. Stay for the radicalization.
Yes. Okay, so let's start with the outside of the Trojan horse. What makes a hot dog great to you? And what were, say, your top three favorite dogs across the country?
Ooh. Well, again, I mean, I guess getting back to my issue with ketchup hatred, the best hot dog in the world is your favorite hot dog. But for me, that hot dog, and this changed on the trip because I also grew up with boiled hot dogs in New England. And that was, you know, the greatest thing in the entire world. And then and then I moved to Southern California and my world opened up a little. Mm. So now, based on my research, my favorite hot dog is a toasted bun, a split grilled to a slight char all beef hot dog with ketchup, mustard, relish, and maybe some onions on top. That is nice. My perfect barbecue hot dog. My favorite hot dogs across the country, Rutt's Hut is one of them.
New Jersey, represent.
Jersey really has it figured out. Like, New York and Chicago are the loudest
about
it. No
one's ever said that before.
Nor will they again. But on this one issue, hot dogs on the side of the highway, they reign supreme. Rutt's Hut does the Ripper, as you know, a slightly deep-fried hot dog just for a couple seconds. It's the perfect bite, I think, and it's also super cost-effective. The environment is amazing. I went on biker night, so there were just 200 elderly bikers eating hot dogs and drinking beer. It was the greatest. So that's my top, and that's a lot of people's top. I was almost disappointed in myself, but they have it. So I'm not going to be, you know, not like the other girls on that issue. another hot dog I love, I live in Los Angeles, and it turns out one of the best hot dogs in the country is a mile from where I live, outside Dodger Stadium or the Staples Center. I refuse to call it the other name. But they have something called the Danger Dog, which is sort of a variation on a Mexican hot dog that it's bacon wrapped and cooked by independent vendors. You pay on Venmo. They're delicious. They're so filling, and they're way better than what's available inside of the stadium where you just saw whatever. Yeah. So that's a top. And then my third favorite hot dog is in Portland, Oregon. It's called a Korean hot dog from a place called Kim Jong Grillin. It's unbelievable. It's so good. So the Kim Jong Grillin hot dog, locally sourced meat on a banh mi baguette with sesame sprouts, spicy daikon, kimchi mayo, and pickled mango.
Nice.
It's unbelievable. It's so good. So that's my third favorite.
That sounds incredible. Although I kind of can't believe the name of that business, but okay. And then there were ones you wrote about that were truly awful.
Yeah.
What are some of the most cursed hot dogs that you had?
The most cursed hot dog I had was in Albuquerque. I respect the effort. I respect the hustle. I love when someone really tries something out. There was also one I had in North Hollywood in California, that was a peanut butter and jelly hot dog. That was a swing and a miss. But the worst one, unfortunately, because it was so close to being good, was in Albuquerque. I got something called the Three Ring Circus, which is a hot dog with three types of rings. Onion rings, great.
Great.
Little pepper rings.
Super.
Great. But then the third ring is SpaghettiOs, just like slopped lukewarm out the can SpaghettiOs, and that was what really brought it into inedible territory for me. I've eaten so many disgusting things, Francis, and I just like I could not do it. It was
like you didn't
much.
Even try. You just saw it and you're like, this is conceptually a no-go.
I had two bites and I was like, no, this really, this is this is an affront to God. I can't continue with this.
There is something about something that is just truly awful, but like it's more disappointing when it was so close to being good, because a hot dog topped with onion rings and little like chili pepper rings mm-hmm. really is 2/3 of the way to sublime.
And it's a brilliant idea. I think that really, I wonder if it's changed in the 2 years since I've been, because they just need a different third ring. Like surely there's another ring-shaped food that would not make me want to run into traffic. And I believe they can do it.
Like, my God, just take a hole punch to a slice of cheese. You're good.
Yeah, Swiss cheese, the hot dog. There's the rings. We're done. And nevertheless.
That is disappointing.
Truly shocking.
Okay, so you actually mentioned this earlier. How did the hot dog become such a symbol of America? How did that start?
Ooh, well, I think what I sort of land on in the book is that it's a combination of two very American feeling concepts, which is just really aggressive, kind of irrational marketing campaigns and exploitation of labor. I think those are the two very American elements of the hot dog. But in terms of like how we view them now, it's kind of hard to trace because of the weird marketing campaigns. For example, I was at, because I cannot let it go. It's no longer a business expense. It's just a personal interest at this point. I went to the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest a couple of days ago, just to kind of see what was going on in the community. And because of how that event is marketed, you're told at the press junket that it's been going on since 1916, when like a Greek and a Polish immigrant spoke to each other and said, "I'm more American than you. No, I'm more American than you. Let's have a hot dog contest about it," which of course is completely made up. The hot dog contest started in the 70s.
They're just lying to you.
They're just lying to you. As close to the truth that I was able to find is that hot dogs became popular in the U.S. Around the time of the stock market crash in the late 1920s into the Great Depression, because they were cheap to make and they were very filling. Most of the early hot dogs that got popular, I mean, there's a lot of stories about like, you know, I think stuff we see in tech now of like one brave white guy like did this and changed the world, which again is not true. It's a number of small businesses made this dish popular because people could afford it. And also that it was delicious and regionally specific. The hot dog is, you know, very specific to where you are. And so I think by the end of the Great Depression, it had sort of built up this reputation as the meal of the people. And it's kind of stayed that way in a way that I think, you know, some marketing campaigns and companies take advantage of. But in general, I think it's kind of a nice thing.
Jamie Loftus is the author of Raw Dog, The Naked Truth About Hot Dogs. More with her in a minute. And then we get the goods on the Mexican way with the grill, with Bricio Lopez. And believe me, you want to be invited to Bricio's backyard for an asada. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're all about the American summer today, and no American summer is complete without hot dogs. We're talking with Jamie Loftus, author of an extensive history of the tube steak called Raw Dog. Let's get back to it with her.
You had mentioned, too, like this, like the mass industrialization, really, of any food ends up almost inevitably creating really tough, if not straight-up exploitative labor conditions.
Yeah.
And, you know, famously, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, which you also, you know, write about in the book, yeah. was meant to be a book about the horrors of unfettered capitalism, but really became famous because everyone's like, wait, that's what meat factories are like? I don't want that.
Right. There is like a great quote from him that's something akin to like, I meant to hit Americans in their minds. I ended up hitting them in their stomachs, which is kind of true. Where, yeah, that is, I think, a very effective piece of, you know, taking down the concept of the American dream. But the only, I mean, not the only lasting impact, but the most immediate impact of it was that because Upton Sinclair had done research by working in Chicago meat processing plants as these industrialized systems were developing, he reported on, you know, not how obviously horrible it is just for the animals, but also for the employees working there. And The Jungle inspired two laws around labor and regulation in meatpacking factories that still exist today. And from my account, I think that that, you know, that was over 100 years ago, and that's still the strongest piece of writing that has affected meat processing plants. There's been a lot of great reporting since then, mm-hmm. but the dial has moved very little. And it was, I didn't even really fully realize it until I was researching, you know, I was doing this trip sort of towards the end of the lockdown era. It was in the summer of 2021, mm-hmm. and doing research about how the meatpacking industry was impacted specifically by COVID was horrific. And, you know, the only laws really put in place in regards to meatpacking were actually sort of setting the clock backwards mm-hmm. by putting in these, they're called AGAG laws, that essentially make it really difficult for journalists to report on what's going on in meatpacking factories and for employees to report or document what goes on in their own workplaces. And so I was really infuriated by, you know, the fact that it had been really about 100 years since any effective big step forward had been taken in that space. And that's, you know, I mean, that's a part of all meat, but the hot dog is certainly a part of that.
Yeah. Like, that was an absolute horror show. Like the meatpacking plants that were essentially compelled to stay open, even when other industries were shutting down during COVID, and how many people got sick and how many people died because of that.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think you do address this in the book, you know, talking about this sort of conflict you feel between, you know, someone who's writing a really fun and funny book about hot dogs and how much you love hot dogs, but also like realizing like, it's also not a completely, it's not a pure pleasure, right? Like, if you stop to think about it, there are all these things going on behind the scenes that, like, you know, you have to wrestle with. But aside from that sort of moral quandary, aside from the moral quandary of your hot dog book,
yeah,
what was the most challenging part of doing this?
Oh my gosh. I mean, there is the physical component of it. Where
how many hot dogs did you eat through the course of the research for this book?
Every hot dog I ate is not in the book. It was over 200 in of like different hot dog makes and places and stuff like that that I went to. And I sort of tried to pare it down to the ones that I thought were the most impactful. Some would say still too many. but yeah, I mean, physically it was a little punishing. But I think it, and outside of the moral quandary stuff, I mean, it's just, it's such a deceptively large topic. There are so many things that I could have talked about that I either decided not to, or we cut late in the editing process. Like, I turned in a way longer manuscript than made any human sense. But I mean, I think it's, that's part of why I really love it. It's like, you can find a way into talking about almost any element of American culture, for better or for worse, by taking the hot dog as a starting point. It's a very like 6 degrees of separation kind of talisman. So the hardest part was kind of narrowing down what do I feel is the most important and still have this book feel kind of cohesive.
Well, I'm glad you did it. This was an important step forward for all of us amateur hot dog historians. and also, you know, it gave us a lot to think about as well.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I truly had like the time of my life writing it. And moral quandary wise, I'm still eating hot dogs. I just went to the contest I'm kind of pilled.
You've been hot dog pilled. There's no getting out of it.
Yeah, I think there's maybe no turning back.
Right. Well, let us face forward, Jamie. Let us face forward and enjoy our encased meats.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, it was great to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming by.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Jamie Loftus is the author of Raw Dog, The Naked Truth About Hot Dogs. If you didn't grow up with them, you may be forgiven for thinking an asada was a description, a word in Spanish that means grilled or roasted. Or you might be thinking it's a kind of taco, as in carne asada. But what an asada really is, it's a party. It's a cookout with marinated meats, fresh tortillas, multiple salsas, music, family, friends. And here to guide us through the whole shebang is our friend, author of Asada, The Art of Mexican-Style Grilling, Bricia Lopez.
Hola, Bricia. It's great to have you.
Hola, Francis. It's so great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
It is always a pleasure, and especially because it's hot out. I want to be thinking about grilling food.
Yes.
And your new book is all about that. So actually your first book.
Yes, 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 and yes.
Yeah. So your first book was all about Oaxaca, right? But this book is really kind of as much about Southern California and Mexican America as it is about Mexico. So there's a tradition of an asada that you smell everywhere in your neighborhood on the weekends. Tell us what it is.
So an asada, I would say, is similar to a cookout. I think that's the closest resemblance that I can refer it to, right? It's a get-together. It's a gathering of loved ones all around food. It's not taco night. It's not a dinner party.
Yeah.
It's a place to party and have food while having fun. In this book, Asada, it's really my life after I moved to LA and the beautifulness that comes with being Mexican-American in Los Angeles and having this community of people around you, connecting all around food, parties, music, drinks, again, food, and coming
food
together really anywhere from the park to your backyard to parking lots of a apartment building is really about connecting with the people that share those same experiences as you, those same immigrant experiences of you, those same Mexican-American stories, and all arounding meat and rice and beans and salsa and tortillas and ceviche and all those wonderfulness things. And yeah, it's something just so beautiful around the asada culture of LA and coming together around food. It's a big party. Having an asada is, or being invited to someone's asada is a big deal here. Like obviously you're invited to my asada, Francis. Anytime you come to LA, you're obviously invited. But I think it's a way of welcoming you into my family, into saying, you're also family. Come to my home. Let me feed you. Meet my friends and be part of my circle. So I think like that when you're invited to the asada, it's a big deal in our culture.
Oh, I love that. So, okay, so set the stage. So I'm on my way. I'm in the car. What am I going to see when I get there? What is an asada in your backyard?
Well, number one, Francis Lamb, don't come empty-handed, okay? You have to come with something. So
good note.
Either get yourself a nice bottle of tequila or mezcal or a nice ceviche platter or bring something or a gelatina, a dessert. People always bring cake for some reason. Just bring something with you. Beer is always great. A nice craft beer is always nice. Mm. So I'm going to walk you through a Bricia Lopez asada. So you come into my home and I don't know what kind of person you are, Francis. So I don't know if you're going to show up at 2. Like if everyone tells me, wait, let's go to the asada. What time? I tell people, come anytime after 2. Not sure if you're like the 2 o'clock person, you're the 4 o'clock person, or you're the 6 o'clock person. I'm going to guess you're the 2 o'clock person because you have kids and you're trying to get out of there early, right?
Maybe so, like 2:30. I still want to be on a little bit of mystique.
Got it. Yeah. Got it. 2:15. So, you know, 2:15 rules in, you come in, you're probably going to be the fourth person there, and you will be welcomed in a spread of chicharrón, cheese, guacamole, salsas, and probably a ceviche.
Okay.
And you will see the smoke, you know, the fire starting in my grill. I usually have 2 grills going at the same time, depending on the amount of people I'm going to have.
Okay.
And then you'll be welcomed with some sort of drink, either a really nice non-alcoholic drink, something sparkly. A michelada, always, because you know I love micheladas.
You love michelada. Well, tell us what a michelada is for those of us who don't know.
Oh, I mean, micheladas are at the center of an asada, which is what really sparked this whole asada movement in my life, I think.
Okay.
Micheladas are a beer cocktail, I think, at the essence.
Mm-hmm.
I always like to say what it's not first. I think there's a really big misconception that micheladas are just Bloody Marys with beer, and they call them like bloody beers, and it's absolutely not it.
Mm.
So it's a combination of spices, lemon juice, salt, pepper, to really amplify the flavor of beer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's refreshing, it's spicy, it's salty, it kind of wakens your taste buds and gets you ready for you to have what you're about to have. So it pairs perfectly with everything in the spread. We won't get into the tequila until maybe 5, 6 p.m.-ish because everyone is like, you know, trying to be nice and civil, like, oh, no, no, we're fine, we're fine. And then around 5 o'clock, someone will walk up to the bar and open the bottle. And then once the tequila bottle is open, it's like, okay. Like
now
the party started.
Yeah.
Oh, now it's on. Yeah. Now you guys are going to stay here until 2 a.m. There's music going. I'm so blessed. I have so many incredible friends that love music who are DJs. Like someone will probably bring their DJ like set up and play music, or someone will be in charge of a playlist. And then once the colts are ready, I will start throwing the meat and the chicken together at the same time. I have my beans already inside made. I have my rice. I have my nopalitos, which are cactus paddles,
mm-hmm.
and spring onions. I love me a spring onion.
Mm.
Oh my gosh, I love me a spring onion. And that's just with olive oil and salt. And I throw it on the grill. That's the first thing I throw on the grill, actually. And then everything just sort of starts coming out. And then people will just come. And we have about like a couple of rounds of meat, then we have a little break, then we keep going with the meat, and I just grill everything as it goes. And I always have both flour and corn tortillas because it's LA and we have both, you know, the hardcore flour people. And then of course corn is the center of who I am, so of course I have like the best corn tortillas.
Mm. But let's talk about the food then. In the book there are many recipes for different marinades and different meats. But you pointed out two that you really love in particular. One is the carne asada clásica,
mm-hmm.
and the other is the citrus and oregano pollo asado. So tell me about those recipes.
So the carne asada clásica, I really tried to mimic and recreate that carne asada you find in the aisles of an LA carniceria. So in Mexican grocery stores, you will see like a big sign on top that says carniceria, and that's your butcher area.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of this section is you can just buy pre-marinated meat, throw it in the grill, and have the best time. I really wanted to recreate those flavors. I would make this and I would feed it to friends, and I did not stop until every single person told me, like, dang, this tastes exactly like something I would buy at so-and-so butcher shop and so-and-so butcher shop. So for me, it just tastes, I think, of the essence of LA, and I'm so proud of this recipe.
Yeah. What's in the marinade?
Beer, okay. Citrus, cumin, onions, garlic, a lot of salt, pepper. But I think it's just a combination of all those flavors coming together. And also
awesome.
My favorite meat cuts to use for the asada are number one, flap and flanken ribs. Those, I think, are the essential meat cuts for the asada. You can use a skirt. That's fine. A little bit thicker. But for me, if I'm going to choose two, flanken ribs and flap.
Okay. So flanken ribs are like short ribs, but you cut across the rib, right? So it's not like the big dinosaur rib. You just cut across it. So it's like short rib meat.
Yeah. It's just it's fatty, has cartilage. It's chewy. And it like holds the marinade very well.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, I love me a flanken rib.
Yeah.
And then of course you have to have chicken because everyone loves chicken. And this specific recipe was inspired by one of my recipes from my first book, Oaxaca. I have this oregano and garlic, pollo en oregano, it's called the recipe. And it's fried, it's basically a chicken that's fried in its own fat and it's cooked down. And it's a very iconic Oaxacan dish, like home dish.
Mm.
And I sort of took that same idea and turn it into a marinade and then put it over coals. And I think just the combination of the oregano, the citrus, the garlic, the smoke just makes for that beautiful, perfect pollo asado feel that reminds me of having pollo in the streets of Oaxaca, you know, with the smoke and the coals. And it's just, it's so nice. And I love me a chicken thigh. I love a chicken thigh and leg combination. It's so juicy. It's perfect for an asada.
So that marinade, though, is citrus and oregano.
Mm-hmm. Garlic, salt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned something else that you like to grill, the nopalito. So these are cactus paddles. Mm-hmm. And first you have to like cut all the little spiky parts off, but you just like slice that off.
Yeah, you have to dethorn them, or you can buy them dethorned at the store. Usually people in Mexico, what they do is they boil them to get all the goo out. They have a lot of goo. I love to cure them with salt. So I will lay them on a baking tray. I'll put salt on both sides. I'll let it just sort of rest for 20 minutes. It'll release all the goo. I will rinse it, and then I will have this paddle, and you can marinate it in any sauce if you want, or you can just throw that directly on the grill with some olive oil, since it's already been salted. You don't need to add any more salt. Mm. I mean, you can if you want. And then it chars perfectly. It retains its bite. Mm. It retains some of that beautiful green color, and it's just, gosh, it's citrusy, it's meaty, it's bright, it's flavorful, and it's the perfect vegetable to pair with anything you have at the asada.
Yeah, I love it. It's such a cool vegetable. And the meatiness, you're so right. And you have this big paddle, you slice it, and I can totally imagine my perfect bite right now would be a few slices of the carne asada and a few slices of nopales together in a taco with some salsa and onions. And oh, it sounds good.
And you got to hit it with the cheese on the top, though.
Bingo. All right.
Yeah.
All right, Bricia, I'm coming over.
Oh, and you know what? Sprinkle some chicharron on top for the crunchiness.
Yes. Yes.
You're invited to the asada, Francis.
Then we're going to get low with the music.
Ooh, all the way low.
Well, thank you so much, Bricia.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. It was so much fun.
Bricia Lopez is author of Asada, The Art of Mexican-Style Grilling. And you can find her recipe for that chicken and oregano pollo asado at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. Now I'm going to get back to sweating. Maybe go eat a hot dog. We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavani, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffin. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made each week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your downloads. Take some time to leave us a review. We want to hear what you think. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.